Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. It's the first time you guys are seeing me today because I had to miss the earlier show. I had to miss Simply Bitcoin Live. Had an interview, which was really interesting. Today, we have Jason Brett. He is in the thick of things in terms of he's in the middle of the whole regulatory fight. I don't know what other word to I don't know how else to describe that, because that's really what it is. And, you know, if hopefully Jason chimes in, maybe he has a correction for me. But before we get the show started, I want to give a shout out to the awesome Bitcoin company that makes the show possible, SwanBitcoin.com. They're the best place to stack Bitcoin. They have automated Bitcoin savings plans, instant purchases. They serve clients of any size, $10 to $10 million. Guys, Swan is awesome. It's dope. That's the best place to stack Bitcoin. Visit swanbitcoin.com today. Anyways, I want to bring up Jason. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today, man. We've been trying to make this happen for a long time. I'm glad that you're finally able to make it. And I have so many questions that have been built up in my head over months of trying to get you on the show. So happy to have you, man. Jason, could you hear me? Jason, could you hear me? Okay. Jason, you're on stage, man.
Oh, hey.
Yeah. Sorry, there's like some miscommunication. Happy to have you, man. I've been trying to get you on the show for a long time now. So I'm very happy. You're in the Imperial City. You're in the thick of things. So I'm just going to start it off, right? You know, right from the very beginning. How has regulators, politicians' perspective on Bitcoin? How has their perspective changed in the last year? All the things that have happened, whether that's Celsius, whether that's the FTX blow up, all these things that are happening, that's, in my opinion, is just giving more and more ammunition to Bitcoin haters, really. So how has their mindset changed? I've been also hearing along the grapevine that that now regulation is inevitable because of what happened with FTX. I don't know how useful or functional it's going to be because of the very nature of how Bitcoin works, right? You know, you regulate in the United States, companies just pick up and go to another jurisdiction. So where are regulators' heads at? Where are their minds at? And what are they really feeling about the whole FTX debacle?
Well, thanks for having me. And things are like moving so fast. I'm sorry, I was catching up on something else that came out today on the Hill. It's just like a mile a minute. So, you know, back to the beginning of 2022, to be clear, the White House already wanted to do something about crypto broadly, not necessarily just Bitcoin, but that's the way they look at it. They don't necessarily see the distinction between the two. And basically, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is the council of all the regulators like Janet Yellen, you know, Treasury Secretary Gary Gensler from SEC, all of those different agencies, and the White House and Treasury all decided that something needed to be done about the space. And they realized it was a very bullish market, but there was a basic concept that they decided, which is that the tech tail should not wag the dog. So in other words, whatever the technology is that's developed, whether it's Bitcoin, DeFi, whatever that might be, that can't necessarily change what the laws are that have to be enforced in this country. And so the way regulators and legislators sort of started thinking about it at the White House level, and then introduced this sort of executive order to kind of study the marketplace, which has this, a lot of influence, not just over legislation, but also over how Bitcoin's going to currently be regulated today, was, you know, first, they wanted to make sure that they could set monetary policy. Sound familiar, right? You know, ensure the Fed can set monetary policy, ensure they'd have safety and soundness and consumer protection over financial markets. So that includes the new markets that are developing, particularly as Bitcoin is traded more frequently. And so those are two key elements, you know, setting monetary policy, financial, you know, markets and consumer protection. And then the last one is illicit assets, right? You know, what might happen, particularly with things like ransomware. To be really clear and to kind of make it clear for your listeners, Bitcoin is regulated. So it isn't so much a question of like, you know, are they going to start to regulate Bitcoin? There's been FinCEN, there's been, you know, the Silk Road case. FinCEN has put out, you know, the issues of money transmission that's at the state level. So, you know, the CFTC has already declared Bitcoin a commodity. Even though it's not in law, it's already enforced via the courts. The SEC has said Bitcoin isn't a security. You know, the IRS could improve its language in the taxation area, both for Bitcoin miners, not having them have to realize it as immediate gain. That's one thing that is trying to be pushed through on the Hill. The other one is a less than $200 expense could be a de minimis transaction where people wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. So there already is a lot of structure to Bitcoin and regulations. A lot of this regulation, in my opinion, that's coming out is really for the rest of the market. And so where I pay a lot of attention to this is the concerns of, well, what might be a negative effect on Bitcoin with what might be currently happening. But that's been kind of the way the administration rolled things out at the beginning of the year. People are still learning about what this whole marketplace is about. And, you know, for better or for worse, our friend at FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, spent so much time in the Imperial City with legislators that he met with them 3 or 4 times. They got to know him on a personal basis. The more they have now learned through the revealing of the bankruptcy filings, the more he's become hated and reviled, and a lot of what he was pushing through that I can explain, you know, a little bit later in the show, how that would directly affect Bitcoin has kind of, you know, been put on pause a little bit. And there's a little bit of a pivot in a different direction right now. But, you know, for right now, like, again, shouldn't surprise anybody in the Bitcoin world. You know, they still want to make sure the Fed runs the show. That's why they're thinking about running the CBDCs. They still, you know, want to make sure they regulate the markets and consumer protection, not really to do with Bitcoin, but a lot to do, obviously, with FTX. What does touch on Bitcoin a little bit is really this issue of ransomware, and particularly all the countries that are concerned about ransomware events. There was a recent discussion from somebody in Treasury here on the Hill who was talking about, you know, maybe not in the United States, but in other countries, like ransomware, where Bitcoin is used for payment, can get pretty serious, where it shuts down a hospital, and they've attributed, you know, deaths to that. So like ransomware is very high on the agenda. They're not saying Bitcoin is the fault of it, but because it's part of that equation, they're evaluating what that social problem might need as far as regulations.
Absolutely. So you said a couple things that really, you said a couple things that I literally want to take the conversation towards. So I guess I'm going to pick the thing that that I think interests me the most. So the part that you said about how they want to remain in control of the monetary policy. In an ideal world, regulation would be able to do that. But we all know that with Bitcoin, that is severely diminished, specifically because it's more so about individuals. And if individuals choose to opt out, can't really regulate Bitcoin itself, the network. What you can really regulate the on and off ramps, right? They have tremendous amount of control over the on and off ramps. But the actual network itself, when someone's in the Bitcoin network, can't really, you know, you can't really touch them. And Jason, from my perspective, again, I cover it more from the media angle. I think that there's going to be an inevitable clash because of exactly what you just said. They're going to want to retain that monetary policy. But if a good portion of the country is opting out altogether, how's their reaction going to be towards that? You know, and I'm sure the thought, like, these are already things that have crossed their minds for sure. So from your perspective, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's so fascinating that we get a chance to talk about it. Because in a sense, you know, there's that expression in this space, like, this is an inevitable conversation. Like, of course, at some point, Bitcoin got big enough where it caught the attention of our regulators and policymakers and the media to say, well, wait a minute, you know, we don't necessarily want people opting out. And very often, what opting out means to you and me means something very different to somebody in the Treasury Department or to Chair Gensler at the SEC. What that means, what Gensler has described, and he doesn't talk about Bitcoin, he talks more about stable coins, is people are using things, you know, off the typical fiat rails. That means that they're either a drug dealer or they're a terrorist or they're doing something nefarious. And that's a bad way to look at things. And unfortunately, our country's done that since like the 1980s, right? Like with cocaine traces on dollar bills, you know, we've got freaked out about, you know, what cash meant. I mean, it was in the 70s and 80s, you know, you could be have your cash confiscated from your briefcase by somebody in Treasury if there was cocaine traces on your cash and you didn't get that money back. You know, and then we had 2001 with the terrorists. So everyone's looking at it from the security angle. And it's a really dangerous place to go. And it does, you know, touching on the on and off ramps, really is where they want to touch, you know, the KYC of who's involved. But when we talk about setting monetary policy, right, as you know, like the monetary policy now in the U.S. is based on, you know, the fiat system and the Fed making these decisions for us, you know, and so these levers that they pull, to them, it's critical to them that they maintain that capability.
Well, to interrupt you, that's how they pay for themselves. This is deficit spending. Like they need to be able to print money in order to be able to pay for the government in the first place. And that's why I think, Jason, like this is such a, I think it breaks. Like something here, there's going to be a clash. I think it's inevitable. I think as more people opt out, because Bitcoin just has better incentives, right? It's a deflationary life versus an inflationary life where your purchasing power just decreases over time. I think that that's going to be an actual topic of conversation. Like I don't know if the administrative state is going to be willing to swallow that pill. That's a very, very big, hard pill to swallow for them. So what are your thoughts on that? And again, like you're in this unique perspective, man. You are in the belly of the beast. You are in the imperial city. What is your perspective on that?
Yeah, I don't think they get to that point of being able to accept that people use other currency than the U.S. dollar. My personal opinion is what happens is you see them roll out a CBDC, and I'll say it now, if it happens 4 or 5 years from now, it'd be the greatest shitcoin of in the world, like Barnum Bailey Circus, top notch, like nothing like what Facebook was trying to do. If you think about it, right, Facebook didn't let crypto ads on their platform, and then they tried to introduce their own currency, and the U.S. government came in 2019 and stopped Facebook, said, no, wait a minute, we get to print the money. So I think they're going to look to the digital platform and try to like do airdrops and get people to buy in to using CBDC as opposed to Bitcoin. That doesn't make Bitcoin go away. In my opinion, that makes it an asset and even a more valuable asset, because I think what people ultimately have to realize is they're going to have to maybe take a step back and recognize that we're at a pivot point in terms of what money is and what it's all about, and realize that Bitcoin, there very well might be a Bitcoin standard that has to be accepted. Now, are they going to, you know, you're asking me like, I mean, you know, the belly of the beast. I mean, there's tons of swamp creatures around there, and I like to think of myself more as an orange, you know, good guy in the picture of things. But like there is an immense apparatus that, as you say, it depends on, and it isn't just the monetary policy, right? It's the sanctions, you know, it's using the U.S. dollars for foreign policy goals with sanctions. So, you know, in their people's minds, that means that U.S., you know, people, U.S. soldiers don't have to go die in wars. You know, there's a lot tied to the U.S. dollar. I mean, the $100 bill is still the most used paper currency around the world, anywhere, you know. So it's kind of like, it makes me think a lot. And I thought about this before, like with Great Britain, like would Great Britain be able to figure out, or which they didn't, right, that, you know, they couldn't necessarily rely on their Royal Navy anymore as the world changed. They sort of lost themselves as the power over the world. And I think the U.S. is at risk of doing that when it comes to this specific subject. I don't, you know, I'll give you one other example as to why I don't think they get there. Is there's a very interesting, people can look it up, your audience can look it up on NIST. So NIST, National Institute of Science and Standards and Technology, NIST actually are like the computer scientists in the government. They actually created a fork Bitcoin, you can look at it, where they were experimenting to see how there might be admin controls. It wouldn't be perfect like the way Bitcoin is, but it would be using the model of Bitcoin to help run the Federal Reserve and make sure that different people had different votes over monetary policy, which I thought was a pretty neat attempt at it. But a couple of years ago, that program essentially got shut down and the Federal Reserve just stepped in, and now they're just been focused on CBDCs. So
it's fascinating because the gatekeepers, the intermediaries, are trying to reason and trying to come up with a solution to a non-problem just to justify their existence. And it's fascinating watching them do, like, going through this process. And I really think that they really believe that they built themselves such an impenetrable moat that I don't think they could have ever have conceived this happening. And there's so many people in positions of power and people that have been in government their entire lives and employed that, you know, it was always the foreign enemy. They could have never met. I don't think they could have ever of realized that it's something like Bitcoin. It's this decentralized peer-to-peer, you know, currency that they can't make it go away. And they're going to have to compete with its incentives. Are they going to be able to match them? I don't think so. I think they're always going to want to debase and they're always going to want to control. And if they don't give up those things, then what incentive do people have? And I think that this is going to be more apparent in developing countries where they don't have a good alternative to Bitcoin. Right here, we kind of have a relatively stable fiat currency. The rails make it extremely comfortable to use. Right, you can play mental gymnastics as to why you're going to continue using it. Right. So I want to talk about the U.S. Treasury, specifically the Office of Foreign Asset Control. Tremendously powerful tool for the U.S. government, getting to dictate basically what countries are entitled to use money, what countries are not entitled to use money, or sorry, specifically the U.S. dollar, what individuals are entitled to use the U.S. dollar or basically allowed to transact with the U.S. financial system. Now, what's really interesting is that same office was used to, for the first time in history, place sanctions not on an individual or country, but on open source technology, which led Ethereum, because, you know, it's proof of stake, it's centralized, it led Ethereum. The vast majority of Ethereum validators today are actively censoring for the Office of Foreign Asset Control. And all they needed to do is release a blog post. I think that was an insane move by them. It was extremely well thought out. They knew that was going to happen. I'm positive when they did that move, they were trying to set a precedent. Because if they're able to sanction open source software, what is Bitcoin? Open source software. And I think that's inevitable. It's going there. It's you know, and then you saw Iran and Russia announced that they're going to use Bitcoin to facilitate international payments, right? So it's like, we all know where the movie's going. So what are your thoughts on that? I know that BPI had a statement in regards to that stuff. So what are your thoughts on that, Jason? What are your thoughts on the U.S. Treasury, specifically the OFAC, sanctioning open source software, and where is it going?
Yeah, so Bitcoin Policy Institute did come out with a statement, and I think that the main concern here is this is not a person, this is not a corporation. OFAC is very tricky. It's strict liability. You know, just this last week, Kraken had to settle with OFAC. So basically, even if something happens, like if something happened on your show on Simply Bitcoin that you like didn't really have any control over, you'd still be fully liable. Like there's no getting around that. So it's a very strict process. And it's done in a way where it's supposed to be individuals or companies. So the Treasury has opened up a bit of a Pandora's box. And you do have some people talking about, you know, how can this be legitimate? People are even talking about maybe, you know, suing. In fact, I think one organization is suing, you know, the Treasury over this, because if it's a smart contract, right, and I use it or I get paid through it, you know, that's or my wallet gets dusted, right, if I were using Ethereum, like that's not really something I did, but then I've broken sanctions. And this came up like 3 or 4 years ago, 2018, when Venezuela came out with the Petro. And you know, Senator Menendez from New Jersey put out this, you know, this follow-up to Trump's EO that said, you know, even if you use the petro and you don't mean to use it, like if it happened to be on an exchange and you're trading it, you're breaking sanctions. So the real question is, it never used to be like a whole of the United States approach. Like, are we really asking every citizen to not use certain currency or use certain tools? And shouldn't we be entitled to those tools? That's the thing, right? We need to be able to be peer-to-peer. There's no reason, just like I should have privacy with my cash, that doesn't exist somewhere in the digital world. And you do have good representatives on the Hill, like Congressman Tom Emmer, that are fighting for that, preserving the peer-to-peer private ability to use money. Money shouldn't be a surveillance tool. That's what they do in China. It shouldn't be what they do here. And so the problem, though, or what happened really with that Treasury sanction is sometimes the White House gets involved, and there was evidence, clear evidence, that the, you know, North Korea was using it. So I don't know what the answer is, right? If North Korea is using it and they feel like they have to shut it down because they might be developing a nuclear weapon.
No, Jason, that's the boogeyman. We all know that's the boogeyman. Okay. They needed that excuse. It's a very convenient excuse, right? But does it really serve as a justification to bar American citizens from using open source technology or open source software?
No, it doesn't. And that's what I wanted. That's what I was saying, where I was saying it's the White House. So just to be clear, like, it's supposed to be Treasury's call. The Treasury usually makes these calls. But a lot of the discussion, you know, behind the scenes made it clear that the White House sometimes will step in and tell OFAC to sanction. So the White House stepped in this. It's pretty evident. They stepped in and they said sanction Tornado Cash. And who knows what the dynamics are of that meeting, but there were probably people that pushed back that said, this seems like it's a bit of overreach. The other people that maybe are innocently using the platform. But sometimes, as you say, like whether it's the boogeyman or whatever you want to call it, there's this assertion of power and an example that had to be set. And I think when you go back to the summer of this last year, a lot of the regulators regarding crypto, you know, decided, hey, there's a lot of laws on the books, but we're not really enforcing it. And so what I think happened was they said, well, there are all these laws, but we have to actually start enforcing it to show people kind of we mean business and this is what the laws are. And what they're doing is they're breaking things, like with Tornado Cash. You know, there's other examples where the regulators are literally breaking things because they're under so much pressure to just bring enforcement actions because the White House is trying to show, hey, we don't need new laws to cover all this. It's all there. And this is our power and this is our authority. So I guess it's a little bit of Empire Strikes Back, right? I mean, this is like they're hitting the technology hard. They, you know, it's making it clear. It's hard to know if you're an open source developer or even if you're working on, you know, Lightning or whatever that might be, you know, what your liability is. And OFAC is one of the most dangerous things in terms of how strict the liability is. What I've been trying to do and others in the space have been trying to do is reach out to OFAC and Treasury and have conversations with them to help with education, help them to better understand and equip them, you know, what the right answers are in the future, recognize sometimes the decisions they make might actually be backfiring. For example, I'm sure you remember the issue with BitRiver. So that was a big backfire because they, you know, basically cut all those mining machines off in Russia, basically turn them over to the Russian military. So like hosted mining, these are all things that it's just going to require a lot of education and a lot of help from, you know, we need more people who are Bitcoiners to be in office to help, you know, as well.
Absolutely. It really comes down to that, especially in the regulatory front. It's going to require a strong grassroots movement in the United States, basically a race for adoption, individuals using Bitcoin for there to be enough political momentum to stop this inevitable clash, because there will be a clash. Now, could you talk to me a little bit about the mindset of these regulators? Because I know a lot of people watching and they watch Simply Bitcoin, it's like, you think that these people are demonic. Okay. I don't think that. I think that the really famous quote, right? The road to hell is paved in good intentions. I think these people genuinely believe they're doing the right thing. So what is the mindset of that? And also, wouldn't you say that's a little bit disconnected from reality, right? Because how we've been sold on sanctions, the American public, it's for regime change. It punishes whatever. But if you look at it historically, whether it's Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, they don't do anything. Those regimes don't go away. In fact, they bunker down and they don't let go. So in a way, we've kind of been sold something that's not true. Why haven't regulators opened their eyes to this? Is this just another case of absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Well, yeah, that's a hard part, that last part of your question, because a lot of the folks in FinCEN and OFAC and those areas, you know, they're given lots of responsibilities, right, beyond just this one area. And I think there's this commitment to like kind of the old playbook of how sanctions used to be. And I think it goes to your point earlier about recognizing that Bitcoin is this new technology. What they need to do is understand the way that how this technology works. Like, to me, I remember when Virgil Bellini, who was, you know, in the Ethereum Foundation, went to North Korea and was teaching cryptocurrency and blockchain to that regime, and then is now, I think, going to be 5 years in jail and then probably not be able to be involved much. And, you know, and he, you know, he was a good programmer, and but like that was really like trying to set the example of what? Of not teaching open source software to a country like North Korea. Like, they're going to learn it anyway. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do is try to understand that, like, they're used to certain things, they're used to certain playbooks, and it's a matter of, it's sort of like what the country had to go through and understanding after 9/11, there's like a new enemy. I think they have to understand there's a new form of money in town, and it's called Bitcoin. Regarding like the regulators, like some of it is just what they're told, right? Some of them, what they're told by even competitors to Bitcoin in the space. So for example, the CFTC chair, Rawson Benham, that everyone's gonna be watching tomorrow because there's a hearing about FTX where he's testifying. He's the chair of the CFTC. I mean, he has openly said, he said he's proud of the people in the industry moving to proof of stake. And he thinks that we need to move, you know, he doesn't favor Bitcoin. And the CFTC is the regulator of Bitcoin, basically. And he wants to see more environmentally conscious, as he describes it, you know, proof of stake and other types coins to take over. I mean, he said that. He's like literally playing favorites. So that's an example of like where he's sort of taken the climate agenda and also what he's heard about other, you know, consensus mechanisms and taken it too far. Gary Gensler, actually, to me, I know there's someone who's mad about the FTX thing, and I understand that. I will say he did recognize what Bitcoin is. He's recognized it belongs in the CFTC, and has not questioned whether it should be a security or not. So in spite of a lot of what I will admit are some shortcomings, because his approach is just taking forever. It's taking too long. He's trying to get all the exchanges to come in and register him with the SEC. They're not going to come in, and that this long drag out fight that literally started August of last year is still going on. It's trench warfare, probably won't figure itself out till 2023, 2024. And during all that time, you know, you had FTX fall apart on his watch. But he did recognize what Bitcoin is. Like, see someone saying he doesn't understand Bitcoin, you know, the CFTC guy. I don't think he does. But I think Gensler does, you know, and I think he understands enough to know, hey, this isn't a security. It belongs to the CFTC. It's a commodity. And as he said, it's the only real invention he's seen in the space. You know, everything else to him, it's up in the air if it's a security or not.
Yeah. So this is so interesting. Jason, clearly, you know, they want to hold on to that control. You can justify it as to they believe that they're doing something. They believe that with that control, they'll do better than what Bitcoin can provide. I think Bitcoiners believe the human element is the problem, right? The human element, humans being able to manipulate the monetary policy is the issue. That's the reason we got here. So I think that there is going to be an inevitable clash. And I think that their last hurrah is central bank digital currency. So I want to ask you, how popular is this over there in DC? how you know, are we seeing, is it not only, you know, is it not only the executive branch, or are we also seeing members of Congress, or are they excited about it? I know that there's been some members of Congress that have been fighting back and that have been calling out, you know, the downfalls of central bank digital currencies. And I'm not hopeful. I really do believe that the U.S. will go the way of China and try these CBDCs, because I don't think specifically the U.S. government is willing to give up that power, because that's how they pay for themselves. And they get a tremendous amount of control also from that. And not only in the U.S., not only over individuals in the U.S., but also other countries, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
So Senator Tim Scott, who's likely going to end up being the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, I had an interesting conversation with his office about a year ago where it's funny, they really, I wouldn't say it's excited, but they're all talking about CBDCs because it's been something that was part of the executive order from the Biden administration that said they were going to look into legislation, whether the Fed needed legislation so they could actually produce a CBDC, and ultimately Congress is the one that has the power to coin money. So that would be something that they would ultimately probably legislate over. So that's why they've been talking about it a lot and they've heard a lot about it. But I'm encouraged when going back to Senator Scott, who, by the way, is like, talked about him as maybe being a presidential candidate one day, but when he takes over his chair, he's been talking to his constituents about it. And the good news is he's heard, and his feelings are, a lot of his constituents are worried about the privacy element. Like, and these are people that don't even necessarily use Bitcoin, but they're like, I don't want the government on my phone. I don't want to have government money like that. Like, no way. No, thank you. So there's a lot of recognition as to the privacy element of it. The question's going to be is, does that overcome the mainstream establishment that's probably going to move to sort of force itself to create this, you know, keep the power squarely in the hands of sort of the U.S. fiat dollar. And since the Treasury has sort of wants to protect it, my belief has been we'll still see a development of a CBDC over the next 2 years, primarily between Secretary Janet Yellen, right, and the Treasury side, because she used to be at the Fed. So she knows what needs to happen from a coordinating standpoint with Fed Chair Powell. And I think you'll see Powell and Yellen work together. They've in as much said they believe that if they can introduce a CBDC, that the rest of crypto would go away.
It's actually interesting that you're saying that, because that part of that executive order, and honestly, Jason, I think this is the tell. I think this is why I believe they're scared of this thing on a fundamental level, because the Treasury released a report, the name of the report called The Future of Money. That was the name of the report. It's called The Future of Money. And that entire report, only stable coins and payment platforms were mentioned. Bitcoin was not mentioned. And then you have to think about it. It's like, so the thing that started and incentivized them to start CBDCs in the first place is not mentioned in the entire report. And then you have to ask yourself, like, why is that? Well, if they mention Bitcoin, then they highlight the reason as to why people are choosing an alternative in the first place, which is monetary debasement, inflation, right? And they're in my perspective, they're doing everything in their power to avoid that conversation. They do not want to have that conversation. They want to keep that privilege, right, of being able to issue money for free that everybody else has to work for. And not to mention all the terrible effects of inflation, which really affect the lower and middle classes the most. And it's never talked about. It's always about payment efficiencies, making payments better, making money faster. And it's like, specifically in the US, like, you have PayPal, you have Venmo, you have all these great platforms. They do that already. Why is this necessary? And then, you know, you get to the conclusion, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the Fed realizes there's a very antiquated payment system, and that they've been trying to do this thing called FedNow, or faster payments, where it'd be 24/7, 365. We'll see if they get there, you know, next year or the year after. But yeah, it's right. It's very interesting, right? It's the future of money and payments. And I think you've hit upon it, this notion of they want to, they see it as a payments platform. they don't see it as a savings element the way you do with Bitcoin. In other words, if you have CBDC, there always could be, how do you impact the lower bound, right? How do you make sure, even if we're in a negative interest rate territory, well, what could you do? I mean, we're talking about literally prodding the person's digital wallet if they have like $200 worth of CBDCs and say, hey, we're going to start taking 2 CBDs a month out of your wallet if you don't spend it. So it's this culture of this consumerism, of spending, of as you've explained, sort of the way the infrastructure is with the printing of money. And it doesn't incentivize our culture to save, and it's really scary. So, you know, Bitcoin is kind of counterculture to that. And it's funny, too, that that's like the revolution of our time, which is actually we're just asking to save money and be able to earn the money we save and not have it be debased. So I think that I don't think what you're saying, and because I know we always talk about it because we're in the space so much, but I don't think they see it like people are opting out by choosing Bitcoin. See, I don't even think they're there. In fact, you should be coming with me to talk to people in Treasury, because like they don't see it as like, oh, people are opting out by going to Bitcoin. That's actually a really good thing that I need to start explaining better to them, is the people are opting out because they're so sick of the current financial system. They see it more as, well, people are just using Bitcoin to avoid paying taxes or whatever. It's very unfair what they've done to kind of keep Bitcoin in a corner. And that's a joke for anyone with like Dirty Dancing, like, you know, no one keeps baby in a corner. No one keeps Bitcoin in a corner. But they really have limited this $200, that it's all taxable. So even if you spend $6 of Bitcoin on coffee, you and I aren't encouraged to do that in business because we'd have to start checking what the tax consequences are of that. I mean, and the IRS is within the Department of Treasury. So in other words, you know, Bitcoin, they're never going to acknowledge it as on equal footing, even close to being equal footing with the US dollar, because the US Treasury, their brand name, their logo, it's like asking Apple not to make iPhones anymore. You know, they're going to make US dollars, they're going to protect it, they're going to protect it in the digital world, and they're going to make sure everything else doesn't really have a chance. And that's kind of what they've done. I think the most frustrating thing is when I hear like, well, we tried Bitcoin, it really didn't work. No, you haven't tried Bitcoin yet, because you haven't really allowed it to flourish in our, you know, economy. So,
yeah. So is it, you know, so is it really, and then this all kind of goes back to just very basic fundamental things. Is it really a government by the people for the people, or is it a government by the government for the government? Because that's really what I'm seeing here. They're not really acting on the best interest of the American people. What I see them doing is they're acting in their own best interest to keep a hold on of that privilege. Like they want to keep on, they want to hold on to that, and they're justifying their head. I was like, why that is a good thing. So what are your thoughts? Like I'd be so disillusioned if I were you, Jason. So I commend you, man, for keeping up the battle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you. But I think that the problem that exists right now is I don't know that there's been a lot of history of people using their own community money and you know, doing things on their own outside of, you know, whatever the government offers for them. And I think we have to make it clear that people have to have a choice to do it. One of the things I did earlier this year was I helped Texas develop some legislation that's more of a kind of a list of Bitcoiner rights. And I did it, you know, through BPI, where, you know, Bitcoin miners should have rights within Texas, you know, to mine Bitcoin. People should be allowed to hold it, use it as money, right to privacy over how they use their Bitcoin. And I think that's something, it might be a bridge too far, but in my estimation, they're going to at some point come for people's unhosted wallets. They're going to try to stop people from using Bitcoin, very similar to what happened with gold. And I think that's the only answer to that, as far as I'm concerned, is that we get some kind of amendment in the Constitution that is a Bitcoin amendment that essentially defends the right of people's right to choose to use Bitcoin, to hold it in self-custody. And if we don't get that kind of protection, that my fear is that we'll see at some point the powers that be come in and kind of eliminate it. the most amazing thing, like you said, is what's good for the government versus what's good for the people. The most shocking thing is when they started talking about all this digital currency stuff and the banks were thinking about adopting it, like they're saying, well, this is really good for consumers. But then even the American Bankers Association said, well, yeah, it might be good for the bank customers, but is it good for the banks? That's a question we really need to be asking. Is it good for the banks? Like, not like it wasn't good enough if the customers might be really happy with something like custodying Bitcoin or whatever. But if it wasn't good for the banks, then we're not doing it. So it's an amazing culture we've developed where sort of people feel very entitled and entrenched at the top. And it's something that I dislike very much. So
Jason, what you said was fascinating. And I know Opti's hearing this in the back because I've come to that same conclusion. Or it's like, if this does not become a political movement in the United States, and I don't think people understand how difficult it is to actually effectuate change. Like it is on a political level is one of the most difficult things to hand to hand. And I agree. I think it's inevitable that they're going to try to stem the flow. Right. Whether that's stem the flow on the on and off ramps, whether that's, you know, banning your right to self custody, whether it's just very basic things, I think that they're just going to attack that because those are all really, you know, you download the majority of your mobile wallets. If you have an iPhone, it comes from the App Store. That's a very easy switch for governments. Right. And I think that those are all things that they're going to exploit. I think it's inevitable unless there's enough people that are holding on to Bitcoin in the US as most individuals, and they say, wait a second, that's not in my best economic interest. I don't care what you have to say. I'm not going to allow that, right? And the question is, could that happen fast enough? Like that's the big question, right? So do you see it? Do you foresee them 6102-ing this, right? The same thing that FDR did with gold, made it illegal. You know, do you foresee that happening? Do you see the U.S. government heading down a similar path?
I think probably more at the, not necessarily at the Bitcoin level, meaning, you know, our accounts that we'd have, but more at the wallet level, that it, like, in terms of whether we'd be allowed to have an unhosted wallet, meaning we all could have it, right? But have there be some kind of onerous law that would say, you know, every wallet has to be like listed on an exchange or KYC'd. That's where I think that this could go. And that's where the danger is. I don't think we're going to hear let's call it like a shadow ban, right? Or like, you know, double secret probation. Like they're not going to ever just come out and say, hey, we're banning Bitcoin. There's a lot of market forces. You have companies like Fidelity that are adopting Bitcoin. You have enough people and institutions who like to use, use Bitcoin. But the problem though is like, if you had gold, right? Is it really my right to say to you now, I mean, you can hold gold now, but like, you know, if you were to say like, hey, I have some gold, like I need to know about your gold. You need to report it to me. And then any unrealized gains, maybe we need to start taxing it. I mean, I think they start taxing it, right? That's always the way once they get the hooks into the taxation part. I just think that it just might not be the United States where Bitcoin can come to its like full potential, right? Initially, because of the regulations here. I hope that changes. I want the U.S. to be the best in the world for holding Bitcoin, but you know, I don't know where that's going to be. If that's El Salvador or somewhere else where it's very clear what rights you have to kind of use this technology. One thing that they have to change their planning on. And if they don't do this strategically, they're going to be in a lot of trouble, is recognizing that Bitcoin goes around the world. So like, for instance, they're talking about like, you know, maybe if they do self-hosted wallets or have all the exchanges be mandatorily like at the CFTC and like, let's say, you know, just like with a commodity, let's say, hey, oh, wait a minute, you know, the spot market at Bitcoin, it seems like it's being fraudulent or so, you know, let's just, no one can trade in Bitcoin for like a month. You know, just the way they like stop short sales. Well, think about that, right? Like every other country is trading Bitcoin. It's 24/7. Like, how do you stop? Are you going to stop just the U.S. exchanges? You know, I mean, it would be like, you know, Prohibition era. Everyone would be, we'd all be trading Bitcoin, you know, underneath. Like, there's no way that wouldn't be the next big Prohibition era thing. They'd realize it's a huge mistake And they'd realize, look, we can't just say, hey, we're going to stop Bitcoin because, well, no pun intended, but we always know you can't stop it. So,
man, this is it's fascinating to me that, you know, we're living totally two different experiences. You know, you're in DC, Miami, I'm in content, right? You're in the you're fighting on the regulatory front, and we're coming to the same conclusions, right? And yeah, I fundamentally agree. I think any country that has a strong fiat currency in which the government benefits tremendously from being able to issue it, they're going to fight tooth and nail to keep on to that, because it's self-survival, man. You know, they're not going to just, here, hand over the keys, Bitcoin's a thing, thank you for playing. Like, no, it's going to be Stalingrad literally every single day, hand to hand. So, but I think this is where the game theory of it is really interesting, where you might see the development or things that are actually happening in other countries. And I joke around with Opti all the time. I'm like, dude, like, if we lose the battle here, everyone's just going to have to move to El Salvador. Like, you know, and like, it sucks, man. It sucks, you know, and in a way that it kind of disillusions me, right? Because it's like you've been sold on what America represents, right? But it's just been Frankensteined. But in a way, I do see a clear path, and the clear path is adoption, right? It's like, that's the way, like, that is the way, like, that's how you make this, that's how we win, right? So, and I think that is potentially something that they might try to at least stem the flow. I don't think that their CBDC strategy is going to be as successful as they hope. I think that they're trying to create something, and they're trying to search for a problem.
Yeah. You know, the part of Bitcoin I think they're missing a little bit, like, and if you go back, you can listen to Gary Gensler's courses he taught at MIT. And I always think it's interesting because there's a course he has, of his many courses, one of them is on Bitcoin. And he explains what I think is a really good take as far as how Bitcoin might fit into our monetary system. Kind of talks about it as like checking accounts and the way it moves money. But ultimately, he's very much kind of old school, where he's like, look, but at the end of the day, it's not real money. And someone in the class asked him, they asked him about all these different concepts, and he was answering all of them. And then someone like had a concept, and they said hyper Bitcoinization. And so he goes, who wrote this word? What is hyper Bitcoinization? He goes, well, I don't know what that is, so we're just going to move on. And I was like, oh man, like, that's what the regulators and lawmakers need to understand, is like, there's, and I think maybe they'll start to see, which to me is, gives me the hope, the sort of the silver lining here is, they realize they can't just outright ban it or just have it go away, because it'll exist in other parts of the world. And they know, they realize that, well, it becomes a resource for Russia and Iran and China to all trade together. And then, but we shut our own citizens, our own economy out of that. So in a sense, it's kind of like pretty incredible. Like that, it's like that we all have to, every country can't really push down on Bitcoin if you want to stay part of like the global economic system. And I think that's the one thing that keeps me hanging on to think at some point the US is going to realize that, not make some fatal error, really, which is to me what China did. But that was more, I think, too, out of their own kind of like belief in their own currency, their own CBDC for their own purposes. But just in general, I think that might be the one thing, is you have to understand what hyper-Bitcoinization can mean, or to understand this is global currency. This exists everywhere. It can't just be shut off. And I would imagine there's going to be at least the beginning of sort of game theorying that out, you know, at the highest levels of every major government, to realize, you know, Bitcoin can't just be turned off. You have to incorporate it, so you can't just get rid of it. It makes it very complicated for them, not for us.
Yeah. So, and where do you think regulators, where do you think policymakers and politicians, like, where do you think their mind is on today? Like, the status quo, everything's working fine, there's no issues, like, and then this, like, kind of like, oh, this is a fun little toy. Like, where's their head at? Where are they looking towards, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think right now their mind's on FTX and what happened with Sam Bankman-Fried. It's just kind of the way Congress works. And it's moving quicker and quicker toward this possibility of, like, legislation, which I think will more affect crypto exchanges than Bitcoin. But I think right now their heads are, it's less about Bitcoin. Bitcoin really isn't their main concern. Their main concern is people who bought tons of Bitcoin, tons of Ethereum, tons of everything else, right, on FTX and now have nothing. And because it seems like it was clearly criminal activity that was involved. So I think what you're going to see the next step from policymakers, regulators is going to be something akin to what happens with like holding companies of banks like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, where you make sure there aren't these affiliate agreements, you make sure, you know, Sam and 10 other people aren't like living together in the Bahamas. And, you know, like there shouldn't be that kind of closeness. And that's what the Federal Reserve kind of roots out at the holding company level of banks. And that's what Chair Sherrod Brown remarks were at the Senate level. His main thought is we need to do legislation that's going to look at the affiliates and subsidiaries. I mean, what was it like? FTX had 99 different, you know, affiliates. Yeah. So that's where I think you're going to see the first major kind of push on. I don't think Bitcoin is necessarily front and center right now, which is largely because of this. It's just taken over the news cycle right now.
So let's talk about the political donations made by SBF, right? Initially, it came out, you know, and then all the right-wing media was like, he's donating to the Democrats. And then it came out, not only was he donating to the Democrats, he was donating to the Republicans kind of like in a more like, you know, backroom type of thing. But he was donating to both political parties. Of course, we never heard about it after that. But What are your thoughts on those donations, and will they spare him jail time?
I think the donations were very strategic, but it's fascinating because this is where people in the policy and legislative space got really involved in the crypto space in a way that they really don't usually, because Sam Bankman-Fried spent an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill. Not only was he making donations, he was there like all the time. Like that meant if you were a staffer on the Hill or a congressperson or senator involved in crypto legislation, you probably met with the guy like three or four times. So people felt like they had this personal connection with the CEO that now obviously turned out to be this total fraud. And the more is coming up, the more there's this anger and frustration with him when they're looking at just how devious he was and the way he went about it. The donations, it's kind of like, what do? We claw back? I mean, for a lot of people who run their campaigns, that money's already used. So what does that mean? And it does go across to, there's been two Congress people so far who have said they've donated it to a charity, which I personally think is, you know, the right thing here, because it clearly is, you know, from customer funds. But it gets tricky because it goes to the establishment, like we were just talking about before. You know, the political campaigning, that's the bread and butter of the way a lot of these, you know, politicians, they have to spend 3 or 4 hours a day, you know, to get reelected, just raising money. It does, you know, raise this dark cloud over the money that he specifically was donating, both on the Democratic and Republican side. Is it going to spare him jail time? Maybe. I'm not that, it's kind of over my pay grade. I kind of go, though, to the statistic of, I don't remember who it was, like, the number of billionaires that go to jail is almost nothing, right? So even though he was a billionaire on paper, it's going to be very hard, I think, you know. But then again, if he runs out of money and people get frustrated enough with him, they might want to make an example of it. It's very clear that this was somebody who is just extraordinarily, was not making the donations in good faith even, right? It just, he was doing it all as sort of a game. And it's really, I'm sure your listeners could explain it better than me. It's kind of beyond my comprehension how someone kind of acts that maniacally.
And how do you feel about that, Jason? Because to me, that is tragic, right? You have an open source developer sitting in jail in the Netherlands without bail, right, for developing privacy software. And then you have this guy who literally stole billions of dollars roaming free.
Yeah. You know, I don't, ultimately, I mean, I know he, you know, he's speaking, I guess, today, but I think that, like, to me, that's where the priorities of the regulators have to be straightened out. And there has to be a little bit of, let's go beyond like the who did what or who donated to what. I think it's clear, like, if you're going to go after Kim Kardashian, you got to go after this guy, right? And it is so, like, to me, and this is, again, just like with the media, right? Like, I don't fully understand all the parts of the media, but this New York Times doing this thing with Deal Book Today and Edward Ross Sorkin, it's so obvious to me. It's just a way to get more subscribers for New York Times. But meanwhile, like, you know, there should just be, and the problem I think that you're going to see with this specific case with Sam Bankman-Fried is that it's in the Bahamas, and he's going to use that cross-jurisdictional aspect of things. Like, I guess the Bahamas, you know, moved all the money, and there's a fight between whether it's going to be go through the bankruptcy court in New York or there. So that's one thing that, you know, needs to be remembered, right, is he was operating out of the Bahamas. He wasn't operating here in the U.S. And so what we originally thought was, well, he can't do it because the regulators really don't get it. Overall, it's just, it's an unfortunate negative for the industry, but at a minimum, it's a good reminder that, I mean, the justice system isn't perfect. People who have a lot of money end up, you know, not having to serve time. And that's just, unfortunately, the world we live in. I'm sorry to be a little skeptical about it, but that's just what I've seen over a long course, a period of time, of people being able to avoid jail time if you have the money to fight and, you know, the legal system.
So do you think that is, do you think that is a result of fiat? Do you think that's a result of how, you know, what fiat enables, how the fiat system works? Do you think that same type of justice would that change under a Bitcoin standard?
Yeah, I think it would. I do. I think that would take out a lot of these flawed incentives where people try to maintain their power or do things to ensure they can stay as the incumbent, and perhaps move us to a little bit more of a meritocracy where it's a matter of, you know, what are you doing? You know, what is it that you're earning, you know, bringing to the table? So I think it can help. I don't think it can solve the problem, but I definitely think the way the fiat system is now, it's obviously extraordinarily corruptible. And I mean, there's been some advancements obviously since 1776, but we're still stuck in a world where it's, you know, the haves and the have nots, and that's increasing every day. So,
yeah, man. Well, I really, really enjoyed this, but before we go, I want to ask you, because, you know, this whole conversation, it just made me double down and realize that at the end of the day, specifically, you want to stay in the United States. You don't want to move to El Salvador. Really, there needs to be enough political willpower in order to effectuate change and protect Bitcoin, protect the right to self-custody, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that all really starts on an individual level, right? Because that's really what it is, right? It has to be on an individual grassroots type of movement level type of way. So what would you recommend to individuals? Like what would you tell them?
To individuals. I think that at this point right now, like, you know, I don't think it's the need is to like pack up our bags and move to El Salvador. I think like looking to like the Bitcoin Policy Institute, it's a great think tank run by David Zell, and it's got the support of Swan and others, is think about how amongst the Bitcoin meetups and everything else, we can somehow put together something that's the equivalent of the National Rifle Association. And I don't say that like because that's sort of a conservative concept. I think it can be like both Democratic and Republican in nature, but there's enough people out there amongst the listeners, amongst you, me, who want to be part of kind of a club that just makes it clear to people in Congress, look, just don't mess with the Bitcoin, you know, like, let us do our self-custody thing, let us do whatever. And very similar to the power that it really is a grassroots campaign with NRA has is, I mean, you see what happens anytime someone tries to do something with gun legislation, you know, it's like within a second, there's a mobilized force that goes to stop it. And, you know, whatever your opinion is on guns, that's the kind of power that I think this community needs to coalesce and bring together so that we can push back and keep it the way we want this country to be kept.
So. And that's really interesting. So that actually might serve as a template. how the NRA works, and that actually might serve as a good kind of guide on how we structure this on in a political level, in a political sense. It's really fascinating. Jason, I really enjoyed this conversation, man. Thank you so much for coming on. I would love to get you back on in a couple months ago, in a couple months or so, and we can kind of recap where you know the current clown world is and what legislation is doing, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be on your show. Glad we connected and looking forward to talking to you soon.
Why don't you tell everybody, Jason, where they can find you on social media and what you're working on nowadays?
Yeah, you can find me at Regulatory Jason on Twitter. You can DM me. It's really the best place. And right now I'm actually doing this very interesting concept of trying to figure out how to track ongoing political donations. I kind of call it like lights on lobbying. So we can kind of track if there's another SBF or someone in the ecosystem that comes in and start to like alert Bitcoiners like, hey, there's this one issue, something doesn't seem right here. And that's, I'll hopefully have something to roll out in January to kind of help people just sort of a shared database that immediately alerts us to who's lobbying on what. So if it's Chris Larson from Ripple trying to, you know, change the with Greenpeace or whatever that might be, you know, so.
All right. Well, Jason, thank you so much for coming today. I'm going to roll this out. There's a slight 15-second delay, so bear with me. Guys, we'll see you back tomorrow, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another episode of Simply Bitcoin Live. Love you all. Catch you guys later.